Welcome to our podcast episode on regulating markets without stifling entrepreneurship, innovation, and economic growth. This podcast is brought to you by the International Academy for Leadership, which is also known by its German acronym IAF, and it is located in the German town of Gummersbach. It brings together leaders that are working for partner organizations of the Friedrich Naumann Foundation for Freedom all over the world. They would be opinion leaders, committed young liberals, and sometimes aspiring leaders who then share experiences and knowledge and develop liberal solutions to public policy challenges. In today's episode, we pick up the complex topic of regulating markets without stifling entrepreneurship, innovation, and economic growth. This refers to the balance between market regulation and fostering innovation, because it is a critical issue facing policymakers and economists today. While regulation can protect the consumers, ensure fair and free competition, overly burdensome rules risk stifling the spirit of enterprises and technological process that drive economic growth. So finding that regulatory approach is crucial. It needs to prevent the abuse of powers in markets and need to impose some level of economic freedom without unnecessary obstacles on businesses. It's a balance that needs to be achieved and that is needed for job creation, living standards, and a nation's competitiveness in the global economy. So it's a complex topic. And in order to deal with this, we found an expert that is here with us today. This is John Dana Chisholm. John is the CEO of San Francisco-based John Chisholm Ventures, and he has had 4 decades of experience in Silicon Valley as an entrepreneur, CEO, and investor. He founded online software companies like Decisive Technology, now is part of Google, and CustomerSat, which is now part of Confirmit. He has invested in dozens of privately held companies and mentored thousands of entrepreneurs on 6 continents. John is a trustee of the famous Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and of the Santa Fe Institute. He's a past president and chair of the worldwide MIT Alumni Association and a contributor to Forbes. He holds both bachelor's and master's degrees in electric engineering and computer science from MIT and an MBA from the Harvard Business School. Quite importantly, he has written many articles. He is the author of a superb book called Unleash Your Inner Company and Integral, A Mathematical Odyssey. He has also written an article about organic versus imposed regulations. And in our conversation with him, we want to refer to his entrepreneurial experiences, but also his analysis of these regulations. My name is Rainer Heufers, and I will be co-hosting this episode together with my colleague Arpita Nepal today. So, John, it is really great to have you here. Very welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
You know, we have a debate in the world, basically everywhere, about regulations. But then we're all aware that regulations might stifle entrepreneurship, economic growth. So we all, especially us from the classical liberal kind of side of things, would be very cautious when it comes to regulations. But we also understand that people need rules. Like the market economy basically depends on a rule of law. We need to have a system of justice that basically is backing up the interactions between humans. So markets rely on rules and their enforcement. So what type of regulations do you believe are most suitable for the market economy?
Regulations are inescapable, inevitable. They actually long predate formal government. Through his economic experiments, a professor and Nobel Prize winner, Vernon Smith, has demonstrated that property rights, free trade, and other forms of economic regulation can emerge spontaneously. Of course, we even see forms of societal regulation in animals, like the pecking order of chickens and the packing behavior of wolves. So regulations are inescapable. I think we tend to forget or overlook the fact that much regulation of society, maybe most regulation of society, economies, technologies, emerges spontaneously. People don't want to bump into each other when they're walking towards each other on the sidewalk. They automatically move to one side or the other. We have regulations we're not even aware of. We are only a few feet away from someone, but no closer, because to be closer to that might be uncomfortable to the other person. And yet we also don't get too far away. So there's this intermediate ground that each of us has culturally discovered what's appropriate. So, and prices emerge from the interactions of lots of buyers and sellers in markets. And in a free market, no one sets the price. It emerges. And clearly, prices are a huge regulatory force in markets. So the reason I mention all of these inherent organic forms of regulation is because we so often overlook them. When we think of regulation, the first thing our mind goes to is law or regulatory agency, or maybe an executive order from a president or a dictator. But these regulations sit on top of a whole body of inescapable organic regulations. And in fact, I use the term organic versus imposed as to distinguish the two types of regulation. Organic regulations being those that emerge from customs, from markets, from private agreements, and also from common law. Because in the common law tradition, which some 60 former British colonies and protectorates have inherited, there is little or no top-down regulation. The law emerges from the resolution of disputes in courts and by judges and juries across the jurisdiction. No one controls it. Common law uses a mechanism called the reasonable person standard. What would a reasonable person in this jurisdiction consider to be the most reasonable resolution of this dispute? Common law doesn't try to predict every dispute that's going to arise. It only addresses disputes as they arise. And so it's economical. So all of that is what I call organic law, and that I use to distinguish it from laws from from federal governments, from parliaments, from Congress, regulatory agencies, and executive orders. And all of these I call imposed regulation.
So that's an interesting distinction, because it sounds to me almost like Douglas North's formal versus informal institutions, where norms and values that emerge within society, he terms as informal institutions, which is pretty much how we interact with each other, which defines our interaction space in general. And these, he calls largely, these fall within the informal institutions category. Now, when we frame it as regulations, generally one thing, as classical liberals also, we think that if there's a rule, there are unintended consequences of the rule, right? So it's not just intended consequences when a rule is made, there are always unintended consequences. So how do you see this dichotomy in an imposed regulation versus an organic regulation? Does an organic regulation also take care or have less unintended consequences? Or do new rules emerge for those unintended consequences organically? And is it more difficult for, because the premise you're basing on these top-down regulations, then are imposed regulations likely to have more unintended consequences in general?
Absolutely. Because organic regulations are not trying to set policy. They are merely reflections of and to the extent possible, reflections of and or they emerge from the society. Even the reasonable person standard that I mentioned is one way to, in a court of law, try to make the outcome reflect what the society would do if it could somehow vote on the outcome. What resolution of this of a dispute between two litigants is most reasonable? Who, where does the liability lie? Who should be responsible? That's what a reasonable person standard tries to determine. In contrast to that, imposed regulations are created by a very different mechanism. They don't emerge. They are drafted. They're negotiated, typically. And then they're voted on, often at great length and with great back and forth to get agreement on what's in it. And then they don't evolve continuously every time there's a new case that develops, but at wide, unpredictable intervals, like whenever they're amended. And amending a regulation may be a very big thing. And you may have to introduce a whole bunch of factors that don't relate to the common good, public choice concerns, to get it approved and passed. So right there is a whole set of unintended consequences. In my paper, I refer to or give plenty of examples. Minimum wage laws, unintended consequence would be companies reducing their use of low-skilled labor and increasing their use of automation and robotics and AI, which reduces the amount of employment overall. Zoning, rent control, which is designed to make housing more affordable, leads to less incentive to build new housing, reducing the housing stock relative to demand and thereby increasing the cost of housing and rents. So those are some examples of unintended consequences. Here's another one. The so-called Affordable Care Act in the U.S. has led unwittingly to many formerly full-time employees becoming part-time employees, not because they want to be or because their employers want them to be, but because with the new healthcare regulations, it becomes unaffordable for the employers to keep them on as full-time employees and have to reduce them to part-time. So these are other examples.
Yeah, thank you so much, John. Let me take this conversation then to this issue of entrepreneurship. And I mean, the great thing is that you're a learned man, but you're also an entrepreneur yourself. So you have practical experiences there. And so I was just wondering, you've been working in the tech industry for a few decades, have gone through good and bad times. Now, maybe more specifically, if you were able to just pinpoint some regulations that you found particularly helpful or stifling on either side, the organic and the imposed side, are there examples you could give us, you as an entrepreneur, what kind of regulations you face and you found them helpful or stifling?
I've started three companies since 1992. And so in the last 30 plus years, I've had a chance to see how things have evolved in high-tech entrepreneurship in Silicon Valley, where I've lived for the last 40 years. In most regards, starting a company over that time has gotten easier. It's easier to find suppliers, customers, investors, thanks to the internet, which barely existed back in 1992. You can outsource entire departments that are non-strategic to your essential value added, like accounting or HR, using the internet and online means, which you couldn't do way back when. Software development platforms have become more powerful. Back in the 90s, it might have taken a dozen software developers to accomplish what it took half a dozen to accomplish in the 2010s, and which it might take only two or three software developers or even a single software developer to develop today. So in most regards, starting a business, in my experience, has gotten easier over the last 30 years. There's only one sense in which it's gotten harder, and that's regulatory compliance. Mm-hmm. Here's one example, worker status law. So in the U.S., a worker may be characterized either as an employee or a contractor. Using contractors makes entrepreneurship possible because typically a new company is not very well funded at the very outset, has limited resources in any event, and the people it would like to hire may not be available full time. They may have other, they probably have other jobs, and but they're willing to moonlight and work part time, maybe a few hours a week, to help a company get off the ground. And gradually, as the startup gains resources, raises some money, maybe generates some revenue, and can take on those part-time employees, those contractors, for greater and greater, they can eventually make them full-time employees. So contractors provide a path for entrepreneurs to get off the ground and make starting companies possible. In the last 30 years, worker status law has gotten a lot more complicated and biased against contractors. You have to fill out a 6-page form for every contractor you hire just to establish that they're a contractor and not an employer. There was an even more draconian law in California, AB 5, Assembly Bill 5, which excluded virtually every contractor from being a contractor in California. That was only overwritten by a subsequent measure so that Lyft and Uber drivers could be considered contractors, but that didn't, which passed, but which didn't free up the situation for all the other contract positions like journalists, actors, advisors, consultants. I could go on and on. So that's one small example that any entrepreneur, certainly in California and in many parts of the U.S., would face personally.
So if, say, for example, because your work was typically, your experience is based on Silicon Valley, how do you see the range of innovation coming forward today with all these additional regulations that are being imposed upon? As in, do you see organic regulation truly driving innovation in future technological development? Or do you see that there's a lot more imposed regulation right now that's actually stifling innovation in the tech sector in the coming years?
I think of innovation kind of like a balloon. And if you squeeze one end of it, the other side gets bigger. The regulations, the industries that are heavily regulated get squeezed. And so the entrepreneurs tend to move into other areas. Mm-hmm. So you see a lot more software entrepreneurs than you see hardware entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs much more focused on bits rather than atoms. Because they tend to be more lightly regulated. Think of the most regulated industries, aviation, building construction, food distribution and processing, all things having to do with atoms. And as a result, there's relatively few entrepreneurs, certainly some, but relatively few go into these areas. Many more go into things like developing apps for smartphones. There are probably 100,000 health and fitness apps for the smartphone. Most of these are not going to make it. Health and fitness and software tend to be relatively unregulated. How much further and faster humanity would advance if just some of those entrepreneurs could move out of those heavily competitive areas into the vast rest of industry and commerce, like aviation, like food processing and distribution, like building construction? How much quality of life and standards of living for all of us would increase if those industries were less regulated? Mm-hmm. And sadly, even as you well know, IT is becoming more and more heavily regulated. And so in general, I've seen plenty of data, and I share it in my book, which shows how the incidence of entrepreneurs among working age professionals or people has been steadily declining over the last three or four decades, from the high 20s down to the low 20s, per, I believe, 10,000 people. And that's regrettable, because that means less innovation, less new jobs. A disproportionate number of new jobs are created by young companies, those founded within the last 5 years. We tend often not to notice them because they're acquired by bigger companies, and we see the bigger companies adding people, but they're just acquiring companies, that smaller companies. So those are some thoughts.
Maybe that takes the conversation to a question of the balancing between imposed and organic regulations, as you categorize them. You just said food industry highly regulated, and this is definitely the case. So we can see that everywhere. But then again, of course, we're looking at maybe some rules that are needed to stifle entrepreneurship, in the sense that somebody wants to start a restaurant but wouldn't adhere by food safety requirements. People get food poisoning by eating the things that were not stored properly in the restaurant, etc. So it's probably a question of how far do we need to go in imposed regulations to make sure, in the interest of, let's say, public health, that people are protected from such practices, versus the need for leaving enough space for people to create new restaurants. So it's a balancing act, is it?
So imposed regulations have some advantages. They provide predictability, certainty. Many people prefer imposed regulations. If I know that the speed limit on a highway is between 45 and 70 miles per hour, I know that if I go within that range, I won't be arrested. And so that provides certainty and predictability for society, which is desirable. If the regulations are sufficiently broad, like that one, or broader, by European standards, you probably don't consider 75 miles an hour or 70 miles an hour very fast.
I don't hear how quick that is.
If they're sufficiently broad, then they guarantee freedom to people. So the best imposed regulations are those that are informed by organic regulation. Organic regulation provides the learning for imposed regulations. I like to say, I hark to the model used throughout the social sciences called exploration-exploitation model. Mm-hmm. Whenever a animal is foraging for food, it's exploring, and when it finds food, it stays at that location and raises its young there. It's exploiting what it's found. We don't drill oil wells willy-nilly anywhere. We research the geography and so forth to determine where we think the highest likelihood of oil is to be found, and we drill there. We explore, and then we exploit. We don't invest willy-nilly in stocks at random. We look at their past performance. We make an assessment of the company, and once we've done that, we invest in the companies that look best. So it's a very general model, widely applicable. It's basically a learning model. Common law is the exploration for statutes and imposed regulation, exploitation, and scaling up.
If I may follow up on this, to stay with the example of the restaurant. So if I understand you correctly, I just want to make sure I get your view. So for food safety standards, we would have an organic regulation that would say you should store, let's say, seafood not above a certain temperature and not beyond certain days. That would be common sense. People know that. You're not leaving a fish out on the table in a warm climate for a couple of days and then eat it.
Well, probably initially the common law regulation would even be more general. Food that is served shall be healthy, or food that is served shall not be harmful. And then if a court of law complying with the reasonable person standard finds that the food was unhealthy and someone was sickened by it, then that person who ran that restaurant would be penalized. That would become public information, and that would set a new standard. Over time, even common law regulations are likely to become more specific. You know, to the ones that you're talking about, the food will not be allowed to spoil or what have you. But generally speaking, common law regulations focus on outcomes rather than means. They don't limit how you achieve your healthy food that you deliver, and thereby enable a wide range of means for people to discover and implement, and that enables broader choice, lower costs, all the advantages of innovation if the regulations allow for that.
So can we understand then, because I'm having a little bit difficulty in terms of trying to understand this, say, in existing systems, which are already very complex. We're not starting out from scratch in a country on saying, we're saying, these are the kind of regulations that would be really useful. How do we move towards that, right? We're already dealing with complex systems. So is it the codification that really makes it imposed regulations really difficult to follow? Say, for example, you keep giving example of the common law. The other example would be the civil law system, where things are codified, and therefore probably the processes are more codified, right? And so just understanding from that perspective of these complex system, do you mean that to leave the generalities is the best way to move regulation forward and not codify every step of the process? Is that what we mean by the organic part of it?
You raise a wonderful question, which is, what about the vast majority of countries and jurisdictions in the world that did not inherit a British common law traditions? Most of Europe and the colonies of continental Europe, France, Spain, Italy, Belgium, Germany, have inherited Napoleonic civil law traditions, as you mentioned. Much of Napoleonic civil law originally was based on Roman law, which tended to be organic, but Napoleon gave much more power to the central government and less power to judges to interpret. So they just had to follow the law rather than interpret it, which meant that there was less opportunity for adapting and fine-tuning the law to different cases. And as I quote in my paper, there are legal origins studies which have shown that countries which have inherited British common law traditions, those 60 ones that I mentioned, like America, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Botswana, Singapore, Hong Kong, have enjoyed over the last two centuries or so 0.5% per year greater growth in GDP per capita than the countries that inherited primarily continental civil law. Perfect, beautiful example is North America versus South America. North America has primarily, in Canada and the U.S., inherited British common law traditions. Of course, every country today uses a mix. South America has inherited primarily from Portugal and Spain, inherited civil law traditions. The per capita income of South America is probably 8 or 10,000. The per capita income of North America is about four times that. And if you take that one and one half of 1% and raise it to the 200th power approximately, you get about a factor of 4 mm-hmm. difference in GDP per capita. So the numbers hang together. So the question arises, what can the many more countries in the world that have not inherited these traditions do? And so I don't mean to suggest that the tradition, common law versus civil law, is the only determinant of the differences. There's so many other factors as well. Just competence mm-hmm. in government and restraint are key factors in driving economic growth and improvements in quality of life. I would think, and you folks have much more experience than I do on in the developing world, both of you, I'd be very interested in your thoughts on this. My sense is your approach probably has to be incremental. Mm-hmm. In other words, starting with wherever we are today, what incremental improvements can we make? And try to make those again and again, and in aggregate have them add up to something significant.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
No, that I would actually agree on any kind of radical change not being very sustainable. And so to actually adhere to, like you said, what has already been organic practice to a large extent, and then evolve that into a change, reform happening at an incremental level. But the one thing about organic regulation that I want to go back to, when you mentioned earlier how big tech companies are buying up these small contractors and so on and so forth, does organic evolution of that kind create mammoths that are too big to fail, that suddenly have an implication at a global level? And then in that instance, would you see a role for imposed regulation? I'm also going off on this narrative that exists out there that wealth accumulation leads quite a lot to policy influence, right? So regulatory capture by wealthy people. So just going back to that point where you gave an example of big companies, you know, just naturally buying up these small tech entrepreneurs or their products, whatever they come up with, because of economies of scale and so on and so forth. And so does organic regulation create giants like that? And does that actually present a problem or not?
Just the opposite. Look at the pharmaceutical industry in the U.S. There are 8 or 10 major players. Why? Because the regulatory barriers to entering the pharmaceutical industry are so high. Clinical trials might cost hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe billions of dollars. How many startups can afford that kind of investment? And of course, these barriers help those handful of well-established pharmaceutical companies, don't they? Because they ward off competition. The only, except in rare cases, the only liquidity exit opportunities for the startups in that industry are to be acquired by the well-established companies. So I don't see organic regulation at fault at all. I see the imposed regulations, which are the barriers to entry, that protect those large companies from competition as being the culprit. And too big to fail, you know, our natural inclination is to cut back a really huge company like a Google or one of the largest pharmaceutical companies or Facebook or Meta or whoever. But here's a different approach, which is not being tried. Rather than break up the large successful companies, how about tearing down the barriers that have made it so difficult for them to be competed against? And so for the antitrust department, rather than to, you know, recommend that Google should be broken up, how about looking at all the regulatory barriers that surround Google and trying to determine which ones are the biggest obstacles to new Googles coming along and eliminating those? That would benefit many more people. It's not clear to me that breaking up Google benefits anyone, not Google shareholders, not people, but promoting and fostering lots of new companies, some of which will survive, some of which will fail. The market will determine which benefits everybody.
That probably means we need to really differentiate between between regulations that we're actually talking about. We have, as you now refer to, the restrictive business practices that may be induced by certain market access barriers that were actually created by government regulation. So if the government would focus on creating allowing for more competition, better than controlling the companies that have grown to a certain size. But then on the other hand, we also have other types of regulations that would be more on the technical side. I spoke about food safety, but we can also talk about aircraft safety, where consumers would insist there is a proper system of making sure that airplanes actually fly before people are being transported. And I come back to this article that you wrote about now flying drones close to airports. You know, so you bring that example that, you know, should the regulator, put a ban on this versus there is a level of self-regulation or organic regulation that would be the alternative. So maybe you can share a bit more about that, because that's more on safety issues. That's more on the technical side of it. I mean, as a person, I want to make sure I'm relatively safe to move around in my society. Speed controls on cars, I mean, on the traffic is one thing you mentioned. Where do we need regulations and what kind of regulations do we need to ensure our safety?
So I'm not particularly troubled by laws banning drones from flying too close to airports. In effect, such bans, it seems to me, are a special property right for airports, that they control their airspace. Maybe every piece of property should have that kind of property right. What I do find unreasonable, though, are all the other regulations for drones, or virtually all of them. Let me just rattle off. Unless someone gets a waiver from the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, in the U.S., each drone requires a dedicated operator, a dedicated human operator. It can only operate during daylight hours. The operation is limited to line of sight. That is, the operator has to be able to see the drone. It has to be below 400 feet in altitude. The drone must weigh less than 25 kilograms. What a regulatory burden. How limiting are all these constraints? No wonder there's essentially no U.S. drone manufacturing industry anymore. By far the world leading supplier is DJI technology in Shenzhen, China. The only thing that would keep them from further dominating are all the import barriers that countries like India and the U.S. are putting on those drones for various applications. Look at the innovation that those regulations are discouraging. There's no incentive for drones to develop the ability to detect and avoid objects like birds or kites or other flying drones. No incentive for the drone to develop the ability to sense the direction and trajectory of another flying object and thereby try to avoid it, to communicate with other drones, to avoid collisions, to be able to navigate at night safely, 24/7, to deliver pharmaceuticals or spare parts or electrical components or whatever. So our regulatory regime is just extremely limiting and arguably has killed off an entire industry in the U.S. I speak to the CEOs of drone manufacturers, and they welcome regulations. But the reason they do is, well, one, of course, they'll probably benefit from them because they're already established. And two, they tend to be very small, though, in the U.S. And two, because the rules are so ambiguous right now, no clarity at all, and no consideration at all to an organic approach. What would be an organic approach? Well, start with existing laws that a reasonable person would say should be applicable to drones. A drone can do damage. It can hurt somebody. It has the ability to carry a camera. It could intrude on someone's privacy. Well, for both of these, there are well-established for centuries bodies of law, dangerous animal laws. If you own a dangerous animal, you're responsible for restraining it. And if it does damage to someone's property or harms somebody, you're responsible. Peeping Tom laws have long existed to disallow people from peeping into someone's window without their knowledge or recording what's happening. And you know, it's very subjective how far away you can be from somebody or something and record it. But there's a body of law that has been developed for that. The same laws could apply to drones. This would be an example of organic regulation of drones. And then as the cases for drones develop more extensively and they develop their own set of cases, their own body of law would emerge. Let's say a drone lands on somebody's property. Does it belong to the person whose property it landed on, or how does the person get it back? You know, there's laws that apply to this sort of thing as well. For cattle, for example, they can wander onto other people's property. You know, it would start out, drones shall be operated safely. And then 20 years from now, 10 years from now even, as drones become smarter, maybe the law will be drones will have the ability to avoid other drones. Again, the law, an organic approach to the law wouldn't say how, it would just say what, to ensure
safety. Focus on the outcome, as you say. Yeah, you were encouraging our perspective, and let me share that, because that might be really interesting, because I have a feeling from the United States perspective, you have an intuitive preference for the organic regulations, but the countries where Apita and I work, there is also an intuitive suspicion towards organic regulations because many societies struggle with the grown rules in the societies because they may favor men over women. They may allow violence that we would reject by some universal standards. It would maybe prefer an ethnic group over the other. You know, so there are various forms of restrictions and violations that come organically within a society. And quite often, the fight, for example, for open markets is much more an issue with the cultural values that have grown rather than a regulatory issue. So there's an element in here, what is intuitive and what is counterintuitive when we talk about it. But I think it's nevertheless important that you make that distinction between what's grown as a regulation, naturally, because there are also a lot of norms in the societies that are needed to hold the societies together. So not all organic rules in societies are necessarily come with suspicion. And on the other hand, imposed regulations are needed to make sure everybody has equal permissions and equal right to opportunities in society. So that would be my perspective on this.
I remember very well from my years in business school learning about the Arrow Impossibility Theorem, which states that a very modest set of requirements for a voting system that any of us would accept might not have any solution. So the modest requirements would be everybody's vote counts to some extent, so that there's not a dictator who can, there's some circumstance in which everybody's vote could make a difference. And if I, given an ordered list of choices, if I improve my choice of one item relative to another, the aggregated ranking of these choices won't get any worse for the one that I've improved my vote of. And what Arrow proved, Kenneth Arrow, the late Kenneth Arrow, who I had the privilege of knowing personally through Santa Fe Institute, was that you can't create a voting system that will meet all of these requirements unless there's a limited amount of disagreement among the people in the society. If you allow for any range of voting, there's no single unambiguous aggregation of everyone's preferences. But if you can limit the amount of disagreement, you can achieve a unambiguous aggregation of people's voting preferences. And the U.S. is becoming more polarized, and it worries me that benefits of the society that we enjoyed when there was a bell curve of preferences with the most of the weight being in the middle, some of those benefits we lose when become too bifurcated, and we become a bimodal distribution. And of course, the countries that you're talking about have those bimodal or trimodal or other distributions, don't they?
Multimodal
distributions. And so I can well imagine it might be hard to find the common ground needed for an organic solution. My guess is you would just have to set your sights and goals more modestly. What can be agreed on by everyone? Could free trade, free exchange be agreed to? And once those benefits are being enjoyed, could you take the next step and the next step? You know, the EU enjoyed tremendous benefit from its initial four freedoms of people, labor, goods and services, being able to move, and finance, I guess, was included in one of those, I guess, financial services. So they were able to agree on that. I realize, you know, Germany is now moving away from the free movement by putting up some barriers. But overall, still, and so once that level of is reached, maybe you can take the next step and then the next step and so forth. What are your thoughts?
So it's I think I reiterate in general in saying like marginal improvements always sound better in general, but also a little bit of pushback on what probably Reiner is trying to make a claim in the sense that there's indigenous or organic norms of values that are anti these, say, universal values of treating everyone equally and so on and so forth. Even in those cases, I think one of the challenges we face is if you impose regulation from on top And if it conflicts with the organic norm of that place, then it just becomes a regulation on paper. And people don't adapt to it. So unless we can bring about a cultural change, which I see most in the developing world, is there are all these regulations that we think is a good idea, which is very much imposed from top down. So in that sense, I'm very much in line with you. It's we think about it from a very top down approach of like this worked great in the United States, in Europe, let's introduce this in Nepal. And the reason on paper, it could be exactly the same thing that's written. But the reason that law doesn't work in Nepal or that regulation doesn't work in Nepal is it really doesn't follow the norm, the organic way we function. We've organized our spaces, we've organized our interaction. That does not translate, that regulation does not is not in line with the norms that we follow. And therefore, it creates a clash. And in fact, you push further a population in shadow economy if you're talking in economic terms. And so it's a very interesting debate to be had on, you know, can we really impose regulations and the implication of that. But let me come to the larger issue of, say, for example, again, in purely economic terms, there are phenomena which have externalities that could be on a global scale. So let's take, for example, the financial crisis in 2008. These are financial institutions that have global penetration to a large extent. So it's no longer just about, what happens in the U.S., where there might be certain norms and values that are followed, and organic financial regulation grew out of that. It has implications for the rest of the world economy, especially finance. Similarly, environment is something that we share globally. So no matter how much you regulate in your part of the country or in your part of the world, what I do in my part of the world also has an implication to the environment in general. So there are certain global things like that. If you take the internet, for example, internet provides us with this amazing thing called anonymity. So generally, we can all be anonymous on the internet. So even if they're bad actors, there are new ways of forming these norms. So how do we punish bad actors or bad practices when we can't even identify within the internet space? There are many ways now to just, maintain your anonymity. So it's no longer like the responsible, I'm responsible for my actions in general. So there are all these challenges. So in this space, do you see any role of imposed regulation or are, again, new and evolving organic regulations the better answer?
So let's start with the financial crisis of 2008. I think it was triggered, correct me if I'm mistaken, by the... in the U.S., by a policy of trying to encourage homeownership and keeping rates artificially low, keeping credit worthiness, eliminating long-standing, organically arising credit worthiness standards for any lender making loans. And as a result, we had a housing crisis, and that led to a financial crisis. And so it was departing from organic regulation that I think triggered that world economic crisis. For the internet, it also originated in the U.S., of course, the overwhelming majority of the servers, the routers, the computers, the end user devices of the internet are privately owned. The protocols were agreed upon so that people could enjoy the benefits of communicating and with each other. Other countries' businesses and individuals around the world wanted to enjoy the same benefits of accessing all of that. And so they voluntarily adopted the same protocols. To their credit, the original creators wanted to maintain their leadership and use the wide use of it, and so they created vehicles for evolving the protocols. So I think that's a very attractive, organic way of seeing a worldwide standard evolve. So that's a success story using organic regulation, and the financial crisis is a fail story using imposed regulation, as I see it. Let's see. You mentioned climate, and I think the climate challenge is particularly intractable because property rights are so ill-defined for climate. I've often thought and wished, what if there were some way that we could define property rights for the environment? If each of the 7 or 8 billion people on Earth somehow owned 1/7 or 1/8 billionth of the overall environment and could vote their shares for various measures, maybe someday that'll be possible, or something along those lines. But in the meantime, we have focused on carbon credits and creating markets, which it seems to me is a step in the right direction. So I like those frameworks that have developed to manage pollution and the factors driving climate change. There are also just a ton of initiatives that are going on in parallel. I see this at MIT, where some 40% of the faculty at MIT are working on climate change in some fashion, or their work affects or climate change in some fashion. And some of the initiatives are for removing CO2. Some are for developing new species of plants that are especially effective at absorbing CO2, new crops, techniques for seeding the atmosphere. There are just a myriad of different techniques, and I'm encouraged by how much innovation there is in the field.
I just, as you're talking, I cannot help but I'm thinking of a very everyday experience, how normal organization respond to certain situations, and that's usually with imposed regulations. So I'm thinking, don't laugh. So in any organization, you would have a coffee cashier, right? So usually people put in a little bit of money so that everybody can drink coffee, unless the company gives you coffee free of charge. But if not, we have this. Or we have other little rules that emerge as we collaborate. Somebody abuses the system. Somebody hasn't paid money for the coffee and always drinks the coffee. Somebody else stole the stationery. Little abuse cases. And suddenly we have an imposed regulation. So suddenly it's like, okay, from now on, this money for coffee will be deducted from your salary or whatever. And then the tea drinkers are extremely unhappy with this new rule. So usually what we see is we have evolving systems, and they are not necessarily organic. That can also be imposed, either way. But whenever something goes wrong, we see this impetus to come in, and now we need an imposed regulation. That, in a very small case of a little office, and in a very big case in climate change and you name it, the very, very big ones. So this is, I guess, an impulse that we need to learn to control in small organizations as well as on a global level, that whenever something seems to be wrong and somebody has abused something, we need to step in and we need to do something quickly about it, because then we have a new imposed rule that leads to another consequences, which then usually leads to another crisis, which requires another imposed regulation. So that way the regulatory system evolves in the wrong direction. But this is all talking about the negative side of codification. This is all about the negative effects it has. I'm just wondering, are there positive cases where codification might have perhaps helped? Areas where you say, here it makes sense, here I believe.
level of codification is necessary.
I absolutely agree with you, Arinyar, about the human impulse to regulate. It shows that we're taking and demonstrating action. Gives us a sense of accomplishment that we've put a law or rule in place. It can be a form of virtue signaling. But we will have vocal opponents and or complainers, and this will be a way of silencing them. We avoid risk, uncertainty, delay by taking action immediately. And the unintended consequences are usually not very visible, or we can dismiss them. So yes, there are all of these human impulses, and that's why we have so many regulations. Restraint, I think, is key. Just making as tangible and visible as possible the unintended consequences, the negative consequences. Here's an example. Steel tariffs. In the U.S., the 30,000 or so steel workers in the U.S. Certainly benefit from steel tariffs. It provides them, ensures more, increases the likelihood that they'll continue to be employed and probably improves the profits of their employers. So those are the beneficiaries. But who bears the cost? The much larger number of people, everyone who live in the United States, 330 million people who pay more for any product or service that uses steel as an input. But this group is relatively invisible, isn't it? It's not concentrated. And so anything we can do to make visible and tangible those who bear the cost or what the cost is, I think is one technique. Eleanor Ostrom's body of work on managing the commons, of course, is very relevant here. And generally speaking, when somebody defected, like didn't pay their dues for the coffee fund, she would recommend, or, you know, based on her study of resources that have been shared and survived for millennia, gradually increasing sanctions against those who did not comply. So first calling them on the carpet and, you know, maybe either penalizing them or disallowing them from drinking coffee or whatever might be the sort of approach Eleanor Ostrom would recommend in that situation. So those are some thoughts.
Yeah, I'd recommend buying the next round of coffee for the next month overall for the whole office as a penalize. So it's very interesting on all the points that you've made, very much in favor of organic laws, that they actually sustain, they help to a large extent innovation and entrepreneurship. So if these are the features, what are these specific features within the common law system that really make it conducive to entrepreneurship, to promoting innovation? Can you sort of, you know, list them out or tell us a little bit more in detail on, you know, these are the specific features that really make it work?
Well, I think the essential feature is that it does not try to set policy. It doesn't presume to know what policy to set. It simply looks for the most efficient and reasonable resolution of disputes. If something isn't being disputed, it doesn't arise. A rule doesn't arise. Where it contrasts that with imposed regulation, where we try to think of all the risks and that AI could produce, and we're trying to list all of those and come up with protections against those. Well, the fact is we cannot predict what risks AI is going to give rise to, and the ones that we think it's going to give rise to, most of them will never happen. And the ones that do happen, we could not have predicted. So it's really, that's a beautiful demonstration of the futility of this approach. You know, a much better approach is to wait until someone is actually harmed by an AI. It'll probably be fairly modest initially. AIs aren't that smart yet. I mean, they can only do a limited amount of harm, but they can do harm. Okay, great. When they do harm, who is at fault? Who would a reasonable person in our jurisdiction consider? Was it the AI's fault or the person who owned the AI? Or was the person using the AI, using it, abusing it, or using it in a silly way or that doesn't deserve protection? And, okay, so we've got one case. Then another case arises, which is somewhat different or similar. And after a while, we build up a body of law and gain a clear picture for what people in this society consider to be the boundaries of liability and responsibility. And then if we want to, when we have a body of common law cases like that, then we can, in a very informed fashion, write a statute that reflects real-world experience. That's likely to have minimal unintended consequences because it reflects what the society came up with already. It's just a reflection of the society rather than trying to control the society.
To conclude our conversation, I was wondering, you know, this is a complex matter, but I think you have a clear compass how you would like policymakers to act. If you had some specific advice for them, regulators, policymakers, you know, how to approach this regulatory conundrum, if you may. So what kind of suggestions would you have for policymakers?
A great question, Rainer. And let me offer first three very broad suggestions and then a number of specific ones. I've already alluded to some of the broad ones, things like in developing imposed regulations, codify the objectives and the outcomes, not the specifications. Drones will operate safely. They won't harm people or property. And let the regulation evolve as the technology advances, rather than try to predict every possible outcome from the beginning. Enable industrial and societal learning. One suggestion I've seen is for there to be some airspace where drones can fly in all directions at some altitude. And so you can envision a freeway in the space where drones can be flying, but avoiding each other because they can detect each other. Allowing for such a region of space would enable technological learning because developers of drones would be interested in making sure that their drones could safely use that space. Extending wherever possible the definition of private property. People are naturally incentivized to invest and preserve in what they own so they can increase its value to themselves or to sell it and gain a profit. Fracking developed in the United States. Why is that? Because people who owned property also had the rights to the earth under their property. In contrast, in the UK, in 1934, they nationalized onshore oil and gas. Much less incentive for people to develop or innovate, to develop new techniques for developing that. So wherever possible, extend the definition of private property. Might, for example, if you own a building or a structure, might you have the right to operate drones within so many feet of that structure to do repairs, to do painting? So those are some very general suggestions. What are specific ones? Well, whenever you're thinking of coming up with a new regulation, is there any way you could do it as an experiment in a small region? And so you can see the effect of the regulation in that region relative to others. In other words, devolve regulatory authority. You know, beautifully, in the 50 U.S. states, we could and should be running, and often are running, 50 different experiments. You know, how regrettable that healthcare is mandated at a federal level. If it were mandated at the state level, we could all be learning from 50 experiments, see what works and what doesn't work, and probably coming up with a better approach faster. Cap the number of words and pages of regulation. If a brief regulation is not necessarily good, but a long regulation is almost certainly bad. People won't read it. They won't be able to detect all of its hidden meaning and won't be able to predict all of its unintended consequences.
So you wouldn't like the latest Indonesian import regulation that has 1,000 pages?
No, I wouldn't at all. Here's a fun challenge. What would be the best one-page regulation for Indonesia for that? Three, create special economic zones. We've seen the huge success of SEZs in China. Shenzhen, as recently as 1978, was a fishing village. Today, it's China's Silicon Valley. I just got back from there. It's so incredibly scalable. Thanks to its being a special economic zone, they can put up buildings rapidly, try new things. We need more of them. Use innovation impact assessments. What do I mean by that? You're familiar with environmental impact assessments. That's where we have to project what the impact of a new regulation might be on the environment. Or say of a new real estate development or housing development on the environment. What if we had to do a similar assessment of the impact of a new regulation on innovation? Think through all of the innovations that this new regulation might affect and weigh those considerations in before the regulation goes into effect. Test regulations on a small scale first. You know, we never do that. We never test them and then decide whether we like the outcome or not. It may take several years to see the outcome. And it may be very difficult or impossible to bound the application of the regulation to a particular region. But if it is possible, let's do that so we have a more informed set of data before we put the regulation in place. Include sunset laws and regulations. You know, technology, economy, societies change. What makes sense today in 2024 might not make sense anymore in 2029. How about a 5-year sunset clause? It will automatically sunset unless it's explicitly approved or reapproved to go back into effect. And finally, measure and manage performance of the regulation by jurisdiction. And I'm deeply saddened that the World Bank Ease of Doing Business Index was discontinued a few years ago. I'm very excited and optimistic that of initiatives to bring it back. But it's a hugely useful tool, even now that it's 3 or 4 years old. It measures and tracks ease of doing business regulations along a dozen or so different dimensions. And if you do well, it's a great plus for your jurisdiction. If you're in the bottom half, and people can call you out on it, that gives them strong leverage to improve. So sadly, the U.S. has declined from number 3, I believe, when the World Bank Ease of Doing Business Index was created back in 2005 to, I don't know, maybe number 8 when it was last reported. And a great goal for the U.S. would be to get back to number 3 and get back to number 1 at some point in, say, the next 3 to 5 years. If you make a concerted effort, you can do it. India improved its ranking by 30 positions in 1 year just by having a concerted effort, I think, from 130 to 100, or maybe 100 down to 70. If India can do it, so can your country. So measure and manage performance.
Thank you, John. This gives, the policymakers that are listening to our podcast a checklist of things that could be done. Maybe all of them, maybe some of them, but it also is very applicable. This is very practical. So thank you so much for that. And thank you very much for joining us on our podcast today.
Yeah, thank you so much from your mouth to our policymakers' ears. Hopefully they'll listen to that.
It's been an honor to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Arpita, I think that was an interesting tool that we can use when we are looking at regulations to differentiate between imposed and organic regulations.
Yeah, that's right. I think what was interesting for me was, yes, you can have these differences. Other scholars have also pointed it out. Like I mentioned, like North has talked about formal versus informal institutions. In any ways, like in the regulatory space, for us to measure our progress is very difficult. So having an analytical framework in general, I think, is a useful tool.
I think so. And then it will have to, kind of like go through the empirical test.
Right.
And what he would come up as a definition is that organic regulations would focus on the outcomes more than on the means to achieve something. So imposed ones would be much more detailed and focus on the means. At least that's how he would differentiate between these two categories of regulations. I think that's, for me, a takeaway that I...
Right, and that's sort of a useful way to look at any regulation.
Yes.
On whether it's targeting an outcome versus the process.
Exactly.
So one of the other takeaways for me was just regarding entrepreneurship. I was quite surprised when he said, entrepreneurship is actually, increasing despite the increase in regulation. But the balloon effect that he talked about was a really key point for me, is that the entrepreneurship and the innovation is happening in all those sectors where regulation hasn't imposed a burden. So in that sense, that's where the innovation is actually happening. So he mentioned software. These are the areas where, we see a lot of in app development and so on and so forth. But because the hardware stuff in the tech industry has been so tied up in regulation, we see a lot less innovation in that space. So I think that was a very clear point.
And you can see it in ride share business, for example. We had so many startups when Uber came up with this and then others followed. And so it was a rather unregulated area. And that's when so many different business solutions came up. When that was squeezed with regulations, entrepreneurship went into other areas, maybe fintech. But now the regulations are also increasing there. So I can see the picture of squeezing one balloon at one end and it inflates on the other end.
That's true. And actually, that's in a lot of the developing world that ends up with the balloon being inflated into the shadow economy, or what we call informal markets. It translates into that, and that's where the innovation is usually happening. So therefore, I take his point very much in terms of what could be done where all these complex systems already exist. And his approach was make it marginal reforms, take it slowly in terms of like what can be done, what is achievable in that environment. And I think that's a very interesting and a very practical takeaway for me.
Yes, I agree with this, because sometimes a crisis, not just in a society, it can also be just in a little organization, usually leads to more interference top down, and that has effects. And so we end up in a vicious cycle of having more and more rules and regulations. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, we had this conversation about recommendations for the policymakers, and there were quite a lot of them. I don't think we need to repeat all of them, but I think they were practical in the sense that he was suggesting, you know, how about experimenting with them on a local level, or allowing the local level to do things so that we have some sort of jurisdictional competition for systems, for solutions. We have that in more federal systems, I guess.
Yes, and that's very relevant for Nepal. We're in a federal system and we really are trying to, we went from a unitary state to a federal state. And so this is very much useful advice in the sense of, you know, let's try different experiments in different places.
And in more centralized systems like China does it very deliberately. So they would let one province experiment with a new reform to see how it turns out. And that also what he said, we need to measure the performance and then decide whether it's going to be introduced for the whole country.
Yeah. Out of that list, I'd specifically pick up the sunset clause because that is, I think, so relevant in a changing world. Our world is continuously changing. Societies are adapting, which means regulations needs to be adapted as much as possible. And that means that if there's a sunset clause, it all that means is that the policy is going to come up for review. If it's still relevant, we can continue with it. If it's no longer relevant, then we just retire that policy and, you know, move on to the next topic. So I think that is a very, very important thing.
And that, coming to the German experience, is done by certain states within Germany. And that sets an example that other states then can learn from.
Exactly.
Brings these areas together. And maybe a last one that I would like to mention is the innovation impact assessment. I thought that was a very good idea just to say, you know, how, when we look at regulations, how much do they affect the environment? But we can also think, how much does it affect innovation in our society, in the technological development of our society? So, I mean, he had a few very interesting recommendations that I think are a good takeaway from this conversation. So, it was a pleasure to having this conversation. I hope the audiences will be listening into the other episodes of the IAF podcast. And I would like to say goodbye for today.
Thank you very much for joining us. Bye-bye.